From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In 1994, Nelson Mandela stepped forth as South Africa's first black president and said, "Never, never, and never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another." But 18 years later, is South Africa truly free? Journalist Douglas Foster explored that question while living in South Africa. He interviewed everyone from President Zuma to teens with HIV. Doug Foster joins us to discuss his book, After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa, and the problems that still divide the country. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Douglas Foster is with us in studio this hour. He's first-generation Californian and ran the news service over at Stanford as well as teaching at UC Berkeley and was editor of Mother Jones Magazine and is presently associate professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. He's been published in The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, The Los Angeles Times, and The Smithsonian. Recently, he wrote a book on South Africa, After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Joins us in studio, and good to have you back with us.
It's great to be with you, Michael.
I was mentioning to Doug, in fact, he actually filled in for me on Forum. I don't know how long ago that was, back in the early tenure of my being behind the microphone here, but did a splendid job and delighted to have you back here. And this is an important book. We're talking, in fact, before we went on the air about how, you know, South Africa was one of those miracles like the Arab Spring, and there was so much intense passion and interest in overturning apartheid and the apartheid regime, and Nelson Mandela, of course, one of the great icons of the 20th century. And I remember the voters lining up and just what it was, the thrill of getting the franchise. Almost every South African was there of all colors and so forth. Now in the West, the interest is, well, perhaps I wouldn't say minimal, but marginal. The miracle has, as you point out in your book, turned into maybe somewhat of a cataclysm. I mean, that seems, I was talking about trajectory in the last hour with the guests, and but not so much maybe a cataclysm, just, is it a cataclysm?
No, I think that's the problem when we look at Africa, is that we're used to two narratives. An Afro-pessimistic kind of narrative of catastrophe all the time, or the miracle. And one of the reasons those of us in the New Left got so interested in South Africa and got so invested in the idea that there was a connection between our freedom and theirs was the personification of the anti-apartheid movement in the person of Nelson Mandela. So in demonstrations against the Vietnam War, we held up portraits of him in his boxing shorts, and his trajectory from guerrilla to prisoner for 27 years to coming out, leading a process of reconciliation, mostly peaceful transition, and then taking power is the kind of narrative we love. And then we want to stop there, as if that's the end of the story. And where this book, After Mandela, picks up the story is 10 years after the political liberation, to look at what has actually happened. How close has the society come to the non-racial, non-sexist, non-homophobic, and more egalitarian ideal which Nelson Mandela proclaimed?
That was his vision, certainly. And in many ways, it's still got a long way to go, like most countries. The ANC is really, I mean, the African National Congress, which was, of course, a party of Nelson Mandela, it's become a one-party state in many respects, hasn't it?
It is on a national level, but there is a multi-party component to it that's quite robust. The Democratic Alliance, which is the chief opposition party, actually controls one of the nine provinces, the Western Cape. So it's the ANC in its 100th year this year still has that respect from a lot of voters as the chief party that led to the liberation. But I think there are many, many contests going on now from the bottom up, including in labor. We saw the mine strikes that led to violence last month. There are many challenges to the ANC that indicate that this South Africa is not on the trajectory to become a one-party state in the sense that many other countries in Africa have now.
May I mention the strikes in the Lonmin Marikana platinum mine strike, which I guess now the toll is up to about 45 dead at this point, and you've got this youth leader, Julius Malema, who's calling for another revolution, isn't he?
Sure. And it's inevitable that that call would increase in the last couple years for a nationalization of the mines, because you have a situation in which 18 years after political liberation, after people were allowed to vote, one person, one vote for the first time, social justice and economic justice have not followed. And so somebody like Malema can get a fair amount of traction by saying the vast amount, the vast preponderance of the wealth, control of the economy is still in white hands. 18 years is long enough to wait.
It's still white oligarchy, really, in terms of white wealth. And it's also a government that is sort of in its own little compound. I mean, to a great extent, it reminds me of the Green Zone in Iraq or something like that. It's set off from the people, and that is certainly not conforming to Nelson Mandela's vision.
Yeah, that's true. And I think there's the Marikana mine catastrophe in which 34 wildcat strikers were shot down, killed by the people's police. It was a dramatic wake-up call. We've seen in coverage of that catastrophe, round-the-clock kind of replaying of that footage. And it is a moment that's shaken the government and I think delivered the message that the emerging black elite, including longstanding leaders of the ANC like President Zuma, have gotten increasingly out of touch with their own base.
There was a good deal of fear when, well, going back to Mbeki, but also with Zuma, that maybe something would unfold, particularly, I suppose, during a more conservative administration of George W. Bush, that something, especially with the ANC, might unfold that would be like what happened in Zimbabwe, that you would have land being taken away and redistributed and all that sort of thing. That hasn't really happened.
No, not at all. The essential deal that was struck in 1994 after the negotiations was that the vote would happen, but the essential structure of the economy would stay the same. So, for example, with the land reform policy in South Africa now, the willing seller, willing buyer rule holds firm, which means that a white landowner can hold up the process for a long time by asking more for his land than it's actually worth. I don't think this fear of the Zanufication or heading in the direction of Mugabe rule in Zimbabwe is at all a real threat in South Africa. It is a kind of fear that white South Africans have. But there's nothing to indicate within the top circles of the ANC or even down at the branch level that people are really interested in that kind of transfer of economic wealth. There is huge frustration at the bottom that economic justice has been so slow to be achieved.
We're talking with Douglas Foster, who has a book out about South Africa, and the book is called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. I mean, your concerns come across as a journalist with, well, what's pretty much characterized as a vibrant constitution being undermined, and also the sense of the working class and the poor not being able to get a leg up here. I mean, what are we talking about now in terms of unemployment is about 75%. I mean, we think it's high in places like Spain with 50% of youth, or in North Africa, Algeria, Tunisia, 75% in South Africa among black youth.
Among black young men in particular, and you know, going back to your last hour about whether it's economic factors alone that drive people into the streets, if you were looking at simply the unemployment rate among those sectors, then you would have expected the explosion already to have happened. What mitigates against that largely is the changes that people have seen, as frustrated as they are, seeing the government moving in certain directions, people being lifted out of poverty. 2 million black South Africans have been lifted out of poverty. Not enough, but certainly visible change within the lifetimes of these young people that lead young South Africans, for example, to be the most among the most optimistic people on the planet. Even dealing with these huge challenges and constraints, 57% of young South Africans think their lives will be better than the lives of their parents. And I think the equivalent rate in the United States is in the teens. So,
well, you talk to some of these young people, and in fact, they're featured in your book, and I want to focus someone on that. But most of them don't really have all that much memory of Mandela. I mean, when you talk about the vision of Mandela being perhaps not on the pathway that it would that we would want and everything. They're too young, really, aren't they?
Sure. Well, half the population, like in much of the developing world, this is a young society. It's not only the one of the globe's newest democracies, but half of the population is 24 and under. 40% of the population is 18 and under. So for that 40%, they only know the new dispensation. And remember, Nelson Mandela came out of prison as a relatively old man. It's one of those, you know, questions about contingency in history. What if he hadn't been in jail for 27 years? What happens in the mid-90s is tremendous pent-up desire for freedom and expectation that change will happen at a miraculous rate because the savior is finally out of prison. And I think for young people, I did lots of interviewing around the country, group interviews, but then focused the book on six stories, three among kids who have well-known names, a grandson of Nelson Mandela, daughter of President Zuma, son of the leader of the opposition, and then three people who have names that have never been in print before, a young poor kid living up near the border of Zimbabwe, an HIV-positive teenager in the South, and a kid living on the street in Cape Town. And I think part of what I'm trying to capture in this book is the wiggle room that those young people are finding and looking for and fashioning for themselves in trying to create the kind of society we haven't seen before.
Talking again with Douglas Foster, his book is After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. We've actually got a cut here of Nelson Mandela, and he's speaking shortly after he's released from prison.
We are here as fellow South Africans, convinced that the system of white minority rule must come to an end without delay.
That's it. I mean, in essence, really, that's what Mandela stood for and continues to stand for. And one wonders about the leadership that followed. I mean, very difficult shoes to fill, obviously. But Mbeki, remembered particularly among AIDS activists for taking this absolutely untenable position. Now Zuma, again, maybe challenging the Constitution and the vision of Mandela. Are there any successors, real successors, that you see?
Yeah, I think there's a hugely impressive next generation of potential leaders who have served as premiers, mayors, regional leaders, who in essence are being kind of tamped down by this older generation of people who came out of prison, came from exile, or in the case of President Zuma, came out of the guerrilla movement, who are now in their late 60s, early 70s, and are seniors in the movement. I think the next generation has a population of people who are quite impressive and have been the ones who have really carried out some of these signal achievements in pulling people out of poverty in a situation that was very constrained. And the one thing I should say about what Mandela faced and his generation of leaders, including Mbeki and Zuma, was that on the same day freedom arrived in 1994, two other big forces walked in the door virtually on the same day. And that was linking back up to a global capitalist economy that was in the process of increasing inequality everywhere, and the HIV pandemic. You can't really talk about the challenge of creating, of fulfilling Mandela's dream, the ANC's dream, for the country without taking those two big factors into account. And particularly with the HIV epidemic, we kind of lose track of it. You know, when I lived in San Francisco, I belonged to a church here, church with 500 members, We had 500 funerals in 2 years. What you do when you walk into South Africa is you take that kind of scale of the kind of experience we had with this disease in places like Greenwich Village in San Francisco and a few other places, and you extend it to a whole country. And then you kind of take into account the level of trauma and grief that was laid over the history of apartheid and the trauma from that crime against humanity. And in some ways, the surprise is that this dream of a non-racial, non-sexist, non-homophobic, egalitarian society is still alive in those conditions when you consider those cross pressures, rather than the other way around. That's one of the things, by spending so much time there, that I try to capture in this book, a sense that in seeing it from the inside out, it's rather miraculous that the dream is still alive and that people are still making progress towards it, as opposed to only focusing on the distance between the dream and where people are.
Well, your portrayal is very moving of an HIV-infected teen who's living outside Johannesburg, whom you just mentioned. We also have a lot more hope with respect to the pandemic, because you now have a health minister who is really more enlightened than we've seen in during the Mbeki.
He is a visionary character, Motsoaledi, appointed by President Zuma in the cabinet when he came in. I think it surprised people that Zuma would pick somebody who was so good. And after so much delay and sabotage, really, from the top by President Mbeki of a smart prevention and treatment campaign, we're beginning to see the results, even in the statistics, decline in new infections among young people, leveling off of new infections, the possibility that the corner is actually being turned.
That's heartening, because the numbers were so staggering.
Really. It's heartening in several ways. Even with a lack of leadership at the top, there are tens of thousands of doctors, community health workers, community activists, treatment action campaign, who fought the good fight and made a historic difference. The latest studies indicate to us that about 300,000 people died needlessly because of the Mbeki policy. If you begin to project out from 2008 forward, when Mbeki leaves office, the turnaround in policy, it means that hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of lives have been saved by the change in policy. And so we get, grieve the losses and stay with enormous anger that those deaths occurred needlessly. But I think there's a really hopeful message here in the way in which people stuck to their guns at the risk of their lives to push for a treat and prevent model.
It's nice to hear how sanguine you are on that score, but how optimistic are you on the other things you touch upon in the book with respect to the vision that Mandela had for South Africa? I'm talking about an independent judiciary, about media freedom, about gender equality.
I think the big one is gender equality. I weigh in the book on media freedoms and judicial independence, including a very tough argument between the president and I on the presidential jet. I don't recommend having that kind of argument with somebody when you're on his jet. But I think on gender equity, that's where the big long battle is going to be most important, and it's a mixed report. On the one hand, women are in top levels in corporations and in politics in ways that should make us embarrassed about where we are. Very high level representation in parliament, in the cabinet, in major corporations. There's really been, we have to give President Mbeki credit for that, because he pushed very hard on the issue of 50-50 representation everywhere, at every level of government. And at the same time, this is a society with one of the highest recorded rates of rape in the world still. and lots of violence directed at girls and women. And that describes the gap between...
Isn't there still also this crazy notion that if you... have sex with a virgin, it will cure you of HIV?
Or? You know, that was something that was a factor, I think, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I don't think you'd find people saying that so much anymore, but it was a, but it was an unfortunate factor in the early spread.
You mentioned being up in the jet with President Zuma, and you had unusual access to him.
I did.
We'll talk about that, but also about the fact that he's been really under siege and under attack. He's got another election coming up in December, which may – well, first of all, he doesn't quite have the kind of power that maybe some might assume. But aside from that, his hold on power is pretty tenuous, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's an open question whether he'll be reelected to lead the party in December. I wouldn't count him out. When I first met him, scholars and journalists in the cities – kept saying to me, why are you spending any time trying to talk to Jacob Zuma? He's past his sell-by date. He'll be destroyed by President Mbeki and his contest within the party to take over. You know, Michael, I don't really know why he ended up talking to me. I approached him. I got to know him when he was at the lowest possible place I've ever seen a politician anywhere. He was facing criminal charges had been lodged against him for corruption. He had been accused of rape and had just been through a long rape trial in which he had humiliated himself with testimony about the kind of intimate things neither one of us would want to have to say even to our friends, let alone to the nation on a live television hookup. And he managed in that situation to fight back from the bottom and to take control of the party and become head of state. So I wouldn't count him out, but he is facing very, very intense pressure from the bottom and at the top.
Malante, the deputy president?
Well, you know, Zuma sort of set the standard for the deputy president being the one who challenges you and then maybe prevails. And so if the road that Zuma laid out is something that's followed by Morlanti, he would be the logical person to become president of the party and then to become head of state.
We're talking with Douglas Foster, and he'll be speaking about his book tonight at UC Berkeley School of Journalism. That's 121 Northgate Hall at 6 p.m. He also has appearances tomorrow at the Montclair Presbyterian Church in Oakland at 7 p.m. That's at 7 p.m. And on Wednesday at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park at 7 p.m. And all these events are free and open to the public. And so is the opportunity for you to join this conversation. What are your hopes for South Africa? What were they at the time? And how much are you... well, motivated to follow through and keep up with South Africa? How much does South Africa matter to you? Those are big questions, and there's questions I'd like to hear from listeners on, but also, of course, questions. Doug spent a lot of time there, talked to those at the top, as you've heard, and did, as veteran journalist is so well-known for doing yeoman work here. So if you have questions or comments about South Africa, we welcome your calls. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, please feel free to join the program toll-free from anywhere, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website and post any questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page or communicate with us through Twitter. Our handle is @KQED Forum. But let us know what your thoughts are about South Africa, particularly many of you who were perhaps out there on the front lines. And remember when. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Doug Foster, a son come home to California, and spent a year in South Africa and is now a Medill School of Journalism professor at Northwestern, author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. He's also former editor of Mother Jones Magazine. And in 1994, Nelson Mandela stepped forth as South Africa's first black president and said, never, never, and never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another. Well, we're 18 years from there, and South Africa is having its problems, and Doug Foster explores these and explores this whole question about, is it living up to its legacy that Mandela became emblematic of. He interviewed everyone from President Zuma to teens with HIV, and we're talking again about his book and problems that still divide the country. And we welcome your participation in the program. You can join us by phone, toll-free, 866-733-6786, particularly asking listeners how important South Africa is to you now, especially since many of you remember the protests and were involved in them, and just how much concern there was about overcoming the curse and the plague of apartheid. You can also email us, forum at kqed.org, or join this program by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on the segment or our Facebook page, or communicate with us on Twitter by noting that our handle is at KQED Forum. Online comment from Zabrape, who says, has the violent crime problem in South Africa improved over the last decade? I find it difficult to imagine any meaningful improvement in the economy if this issue isn't addressed.
Yeah, well, isn't that the conundrum? Hard to improve the economy without dealing with crime. Hard to improve the crime rate without dealing with the structural problems in the economy.
Let me add, actually, if I may, a kind of ancillary question from another listener who posted online. Hasn't there been a huge increase in crime since the ANC took control of the government and great wealth been redistributed among a select few of the ANC's leadership?
I think on the latter part of that, yes. In addition to 2 million black people moving from out of poverty into middle income levels, there have been deals that have pushed former heavyweights in the party into great wealth, corporate wealth. On the crime question, has it gotten worse since apartheid ended? I don't believe so. I think the criminologists who have looked at this closely say that, you know, the reality is that crime experienced by the 80% of the population living in townships or living in the so-called homelands wasn't really recorded under apartheid. Mm. So what you see now is a very violent society continuing to generate numbers that are shocking, disturbing, and certainly a constraint both on tourism and the economy. But no, I don't think it's fair to say in the end that it's gotten worse. It is a significant problem. Anybody who goes and comes back and gives you an Oprah-like report and leads you to want to sing Kumbaya is not telling you the truth. On the other hand,
Oprah example is very telling because she thought she had a school that was well-run and liberated and everything. It was, well,
she learned some things about how to actually move in and do some good there. But I think this, you know, obviously the crime is high. Violent crime is way too high. I think around the World Cup, with the hiring of additional security, South African police agencies learned a lot about actually how to suppress crime and to do things about it. And I think some of those lessons are beginning to bear fruit, a little bit of traction here and there. The rates of homicide, the rates of home invasions, the rates of carjackings, the rates of armed assault are actually down in the last year. Nothing to write headlines about, but certainly to notice that it's headed in the right direction.
I'm going to go to your calls in just a moment here, but I wanted to read an email. It says, I have to say Mr. Foster sounds like he's an apologist for President Zuma, whose leadership has been problematic, if not criminal. Is it because Zuma gave him access?
Hmm. Well, I'll really be interested in what this caller says once they've read the book, because I think that there will be some people who say, why did he spend so much time trying to figure out the forces that shaped Jacob Zuma? You know, he's the kind of polarizing figure that people expect somebody like me from the outside to come in and say he was accused of corruption. He went through this rape trial. He's a boor, a bully, a throwback. And I certainly don't see him that way. I know enough about his history after spending time with him to know that he's a very smart guy who paid through the nose for South African freedom as a prisoner for 10 years, as a guerrilla leader for 17 years. And on the other hand, I don't think there's anything as critical of Zuma that's been written anywhere as my final chapters in the book. So I hope he
will have to concur.
I hope he will suspend judgment on that score. There will be people who will accuse me of being soft on Zuma for insisting on sketching out his history and explaining how he becomes who he becomes.
Let's bring in our callers, and we'll begin, Walter, with you. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I heard the comment earlier that the elite black South Africans have been co-opted and that they're living well. And it's my opinion that South Africa's in a sort of neo-colonialism where you've got the whites are still controlling the wealth. They control the mines. They control the natural resources. And I guess it would be fair to say they still have a monopoly on the natural resources of South Africa. Just recently, the security killed 35 miners that were on strike. And it seems as though I don't see any type of improvement in South Africa. The black leadership has been co-opted. The whites are controlling the capital, and the masses are still there. I'm of the opinion there will be shanty towns in South Africa 50 years from now.
Doug Foster.
Sure. I think there will be shanty towns in South Africa probably 50 years from now, like in a lot of the world. I don't think you can completely lay that only at the foot of the African National Congress's leadership. I think the views you just expressed are widely held by many people. What you'll hear in the street is people saying the ANC is in office but not in power. The liberation ideology, the promise of liberation, went a third of the way. It went to the right to vote, and not to the right to have social justice and economic freedom. And I think that conclusion is inarguable. But I think the premise that it's a neo-colonialist situation in which the government is just taking its orders from white business is not true. That what they're trying to do is find the room within the constraints of being embedded in a global capitalist society to make things more equal in a situation in which we're embedded in a system that is making, generating more inequality all over the place, including here. So one of the reasons for looking at a place like South Africa is to realize that South Africa is probably not headed towards becoming more like the United States. 10 years from now, the United States is probably likely to be more like South Africa. And there are some lessons for us in that situation. How do you find the room? How do you remove the constraints that allow you to move toward a non-racial, non-sexist, non-homophobic, more egalitarian ideal when we operate in a system that in some ways mitigates in the other direction?
And Walter, we thank you for the call, and let me bring another caller on. And Nancy, that's you. Hi, you're on the air, Nancy.
Hi. Yes, thank you so much. I'm enjoying the program. I just returned actually 1 week ago from spending 3 weeks in Cape Town and on Robben Island. And I agree with many of the comments that were said about observations about the people in the country. But a couple of observations that I found is most people that I talked with stated that they felt the transition from apartheid to where they are now went 1,000 times better than anyone had anticipated. And I heard this from people who have lived there all their lives and people who have lived there come from other countries. So it was an interesting observation. The second point was a few people, well, I didn't find anyone who supported the president, I found people were highly critical of the ANC. But one thing that a couple people mentioned that I thought was fascinating was that they said the one benefit of a military rule was that the crime rate is lower. And when I talk to people, yes, economics is there, but crime was almost the number one thing, and everyone had an incredible tale to tell about something that happened to them or a family member. So those were my observations.
Yeah, good observations, and thank you for them. You know, when we talk about the miracle of South Africa, most people really thought it was going to be a bloodbath. And in some ways, when I think of hopeful things that have happened over the last number of decades that were totally unpredictable, along with Glasnost and Perestroika and the breakdown of the Cold War, this is right up there. I mean, it really was. Everybody particularly assumed that there was going to be a bloody revolution.
Yeah, I really appreciated what she said because it reminded me that in 1994, the world's press, of course, descended on Pretoria, Johannesburg, Cape Town to report on that transition. And the expectation, particularly because 10,000 people actually died from the late 80s to 1994 in violence between the ANC and the Inkatha Freedom Party followers. And the expectation of the press corps was this election was going to happen and there would be great violence. I think the expectation of a lot of whites, especially Afrikaans-speaking whites, was that there would be a lot of violence. It would be directed at them. It didn't happen. Even 18 years later, every time there are rumors that Mandela is dying happens, there's a kind of flurry of fear that this, you know, fear of black people is going to be ignited and result in some kind of violence. And I think she's right. 18 years in, there's a sense that those fears were overblown. It won't happen. The press corps quickly left South Africa and went to Rwanda. And I think it is important, as critical as this book is of the miles that the ANC still has to go to live up to the promise, to look at what's happened at the rest of the continent and to and the rest of the world, and to put into context the fact that though embattled, there's a free press. Though questioned, there's an independent judiciary that issues rulings all the time that the ANC doesn't like. That South Africa is still a kind of beacon for the rest of the continent. I wouldn't argue with her about the view of President Zuma in Cape Town, Johannesburg, or Durban downtown. And if I had only listen to people in the cities, I never would have spent any time trying to get Zuma to talk to me. It was by going to the rural areas and going to the rest of the country where there was a very different view of him as somebody who represented themselves that led me to make the effort to try to work in his side of the story.
In retrospect, there was a lot made out of the Truth and Reconciliation in South Africa and a lot of emphasis on the healing and on bringing truth to bear and so forth. When you look at it as a journalist, what happened, has it really enabled for a great deal of healing, do you think?
I think there was a tremendous amount of healing for whites and for white perpetrators in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, because it was an opportunity to come clean about what happened, including individuals who had done terrible things, not to have to go to prison for it, but to have to account and to tell mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and grandparents what had happened to people who had been imprisoned, disappeared, killed, tortured. And I think there was a tremendous amount of healing on the other side of that for the immediate victims of the crimes of late apartheid. But I think what you'll find all over the country, particularly among people who haven't seen economic liberation follow political liberation, is a question about what the price of that reconciliation was, an extension of forgiveness and intention to create a unified nation that didn't respond to the oppression of the past with revenge, including revenge killings, a feeling that whites didn't extend in a similar way to build the country. And I think that's a real open question in terms of whether this becomes a more united and non-racial society. Does the minority, 9% minority of white people who hold 80% of the wealth understand well enough that its own interests are wrapped up in making sure that class and race don't remain so closely intertwined. And that's a, isn't that a challenge for us as well?
It certainly is a Rorschach for us as far as challenges go. We're talking again with Douglas Foster, and his new book is After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. And go to more of your calls. Erling, join us. You're on the air. Welcome, Erling.
Thank you, Ms. Kretzky. Thank you, Mr. Foster. Great program. And as you can tell, I'm from South Africa.
I picked that up.
There you go. I've been following the NPR report about the law that the ANC is trying to promulgate that's going to restrict the so-called sort of critique of the ANC. Has that made any headway, or is it been? I mean, I know Desmond Tutu was vehemently against it.
Yeah,
What's happening about it?
Sure. I think you're referring to the Protection of Information Act, the misnamed Protection of Information Act.
It's really an anti-sedition act, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. And it was the subject of this heated exchange that Zuma and I had on the plane. It's caught up in a inner party conflict, an internal party conflict, and so it's caught up in Parliament now. I don't know whether it'll be promulgated in its current form. The main flaw in it is that it has no public interest exception, and that was the nature of my argument with the president. If it is, if it does come out in its current form from Parliament, it surely will be challenged in the courts. I can't imagine a situation in which the Constitutional Court will find it constitutional, but I think that would be an unfortunate course, because it would once again put the Constitutional Court in the position of having to counter a law that was pushed so fiercely by the president and by the ANC. There are younger leaders and wiser heads within the ANC, I think, who would like to bottle up that bill in the parliament and have it never see the light of day. And obviously, that's the course I hope that plays out.
And Erling, we thank you for your call and go immediately to another caller. Richard, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on Forum.
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call, and I appreciate the author taking time to comment on South Africa. I'm a South African living in San Francisco. I have done so for over a decade now, and I grew up in South Africa during the 70s and 80s, and a child of South African revolt, I guess, even though I'm a white South African and probably grew up in a very privileged middle-class society, which I was probably totally oblivious to as a child. But anyway, moving on, I think South Africa is a very dynamic country. The socio-politically, it's extremely diverse. The country as a whole, referencing the black culture in South Africa, the tribal culture is, you know, historically largely agrarian. You know, obviously due to apartheid, the developing separately philosophy that was taken up by the National Party back in the day is now, there's still, that there's a child that's been born from that, and it's still growing up, and it's really, I think it's going to take many generations for South Africa to become a truly equal society, because since South Africa's opened up, there's been huge economic powers that have now engaged with South Africa, and are taking full advantage of cheap labor from all over Southern Africa. I mean, we've got huge amounts of Malawians, Zimbabweans, Mozambicans that have all gone into South Africa, which has increased the populations of the squatter camps and so on. So I think you've got so many dynamics at play in South Africa that that this book, perhaps, I haven't read it yet, but I'm sure engages some of that. But I'm just wondering if you could comment on just how you feel about how South Africa can progress over the next decade, knowing that, you know, there's Chinese, American, there's a lot of influence going into that, and there's a lot of power that really enjoy the fact that there's not a full solidarity amongst the poor.
And as you said, there's a lot of dynamism. Well, let me go to Doug Foster with your question. Yeah.
Sure. It's a big question. Where do I see it 10 years from now? I think a lot depends on how much room the South Africans are allowed to have in creating the kind of society we don't see anywhere else and that was embodied in the promise of 1994. Included in that is how much economic room do they have to protect, for example, textile industry and auto industry that allow some forms of social mobility. And that implicates not just the U.S. and Europe, but also China. What is China's increasing role going to be like on the continent? In my last interview with President Zuma, he said, we need to stop spending so much time paying attention to the dictates of those small and little countries. Well, he was referring to Europe. And we need to pay less attention to declining powers. And he was referring to the U.S. Yes, China must come. And we must focus on having a different kind of relationship with China than we've had with great powers before. I think the big hope is these young people. If you read the stories of these six young people in the book, you'll see that they faced huge challenges. The son of the grandson of Nelson Mandela lost both parents to AIDS, you know, and has a vision of the future, has a vision of how to build a family in that situation that I think is inspiring, and the other five just as well. So I'm quite hopeful coming away from 8 years of being there.
And again, we're talking with Douglas Foster, the author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. He'll be speaking about his book tonight at UC Berkeley School of Journalism and also has appearances tomorrow at the Montclair Presbyterian Church in Oakland at 7 p.m. there, and on Wednesday at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park at 7 p.m., and all events are free and open to the public. You're listening to Forum, and again, this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny.
I should have done the pitch.
Well, we're going to go to another caller here, and Shabazz joins us from Oakland. Shabazz, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment briefly, try to be as quick as I can. You know, some I was on the statement that a couple of callers back, the lady made about people who have come from under apartheid. It seemed like she or her friends that made reports on the attitude or the situation that the South Africans have. It was, to me, sounded like a really, really condescending type attitude, you know, as if the South African people should be satisfied that they are just not up, that you know, the apartheid regime is gone and equality should not even be a desire. You know, the whole struggle of anti-apartheid was, anti-apartheid was to realize their human potential in total equality, not just to, and this is in all aspects of life, you know. And for someone to say, well, they should, you know, in the sense I got out of what she was saying is that, you know, they should just be satisfied to be free, you know, from the ruling of the apartheid government. And lastly, I would like to say, and that is that, you know, your guest continues to equate, you know, homosexuality, and he always mentioned homophobic attitude. You know, and I wish people would stop trying to, you know, equate that issue with the struggle of black folks. South Africa, the African-American struggle here in the United States is not even on the same planet together. You know, you got...
Well, excuse me, but in the South African context, it's very much on the same planet. Marbled into the South African constitution, the most progressive constitution in the world, is explicit recognition of these principles. Wait a minute. Non-racialism, non-sexist attitudes, non-homophobic attitudes, and a more egalitarian society. Those are marbled into the Constitution. They're part of the vision articulated by the ANC in the beginning. And you may make the case that that should be hived out, but that's not the South African experience.
Well, let me just finish my point. You know, you will find people who are participating in gay lifestyle all over the world. I'm not arguing that people got a right to love who they want to love.
The point I'm trying to make
is that in terms of ethnicity, it is not an ethnic identification. It is not a minority identification.
Well, nobody said it was an ethnic identification. What I said is that it's one of the four key components of the vision of a new kind of society at the southern tip of Africa, articulated not by me, although I fully agree that those four components should be marbled in, but that is the South African experience. That is what is articulated in the South African Constitution. And so that's what I bring it up, not as if being non-homophobic should trump anything else. But it
certainly be equated with, except in this sense, you have the four together. Anyway. It's
part of these four principles that are core to the vision and to the Constitution of South Africa.
Let me thank Shabazz for his call and go to another caller, and that's you, Jim, in Oakland.
Hello?
Yeah, Jim, quickly if you could.
Okay, yes. I've been lucky enough to ride a motorcycle across Africa twice, and I spent 4 months in South Africa. And the one, I don't think has been mentioned, the one group is coloreds. When you say that term here, people don't quite appreciate it and are dismissive, like, well, that's just a word for mixed. But coloreds of South Africa are a separate group, primarily Afrikaans-speaking, primarily in the Western Cape. And I'm just wondering if Mr. Foster interviewed kids there, has some comment about them, because they're considered too dark during apartheid and too light now during African rule.
Jim, a good question. Let me get a quick response from Douglas Foster.
Sure. One of the six kids who I deal with in this book is a colored kid from Cape Town who grew up in Atlantis, one of the townships that people were removed to. And differences between so-called browns and blacks are part of the tension and the vibrancy of politics as it's working out in South Africa today. You're quite right.
We'll have to end it there. Doug Foster, so good to see you again. Thank you so much.
Great to see you. Thank you, Michael.
After Mandela, the struggle for freedom in post-apartheid South Africa. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers, Judy Campbell, Amanda Stupai, and Irene Noguchi. And we also have production assistance now from Tina Lauberg and Amy Machado. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.